There have been a number of U.S. presidents who have had combat experience in various of the country's wars, but the Civil War produced the most presidents with combat experience, five in all. Those that are well known, well, perhaps the one that is best known, of course, would be Ulysses S. Grant, but there were four others, Garfield, Hayes, McKinley, and Harrison. This morning we'll be talking a little bit about these men and their experiences in the Civil War with James Perry. He's authored a book titled Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. James Perry began his journalism career at Leatherneck magazine. He also worked for 35 years covering politics for the National Observer and the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of a number of books, including this one, which is published by Public Affairs, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, you can use that number. The call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or WILL, if that makes it any easier, and then toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Perry, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Delighted to be here.
I appreciate it. These men, they were all Republicans, and they served not exactly one right after the other, but they did occupy the presidency during one of these periods, an extended period when the White House, for most of the time, was in the control of under the control of the Republican Party.
So yeah, this, the Gilded Age.
The Gilded Age, this period that lasts, roughly speaking, from the guys who bracket the period are essentially Abraham Lincoln on one side and Teddy Roosevelt on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And these men were all Republicans. They were all Civil War veterans.
Right.
How key do you think to their having a career in politics and becoming president was the fact that they were indeed Civil War veterans?
Oh, it was very important. It was crucial. It's hard to imagine Ulysses S. Grant without the Civil War doing anything. I mean, he'd been a total failure as a civilian, and it was obviously the war that made him a national figure, a national hero, and made him almost inevitable that he would move on to the White House. He won the war. I mean, like Eisenhower, it's very even more dramatic, probably in Grant's case. Because the war was so emotional and so wrenching. Nothing like it in American history.
Mm-hmm. The title of the book comes from a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who also served in the Civil War, and of course later in life he was a member of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And he said, through our great good fortune in our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. That's where the title comes from.
The experience was just so overwhelming that it's true, I think, of veterans often in all wars, that it is so different and so out of the ordinary for them, and so moving, particularly if they see combat.
Mm-hmm.
And this was particularly true in the American Civil War.
Well, it seems though that obviously you wouldn't argue with the idea that being in combat is a life-changing experience, but I'm not sure that we today would be quite so inclined to put it in such a positive light as Mr. Holmes.
I don't think so. No, the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats after the Civil War. The Republicans, the party of Lincoln, the party that won the war, and the Democrats, the Peace Party, the party that opposed the war. Although, of course, there were war Democrats who supported the war. But generally, they waved the bloody shirt, you know, and said it was the Democrats who opposed the war. The Democrats were traitors. The Democrats didn't deserve to hold high office, and because of this terrible, terrible deed they'd done, this position they'd taken during the war. So it was furiously partisan, of course, and the Republicans, because they were on the right side of it, usually won.
Mm-hmm. There are certain things that most of these men share in common? And one, considering that we're talking about experience on the battlefield that seems unusual, is that with the exception of Ulysses Grant, they were all, none of them were professional soldiers. They had no military training.
Absolutely not.
And it seemed that they, maybe even Grant, were very suspicious of superior officers and they didn't seem to quite trust people who were career military.
Yeah, that's a tradition in American life, of course, that we've always had this sort of distrust of professional military people. But this was a volunteer army, you know. It was this war was amazingly fought at the top by West Pointers. Of the 60 major bloodiest battles, I mean, 55 of them, both armies were commanded by West Pointers. So there were, West Point was a crucial factor in on both sides in forming the officer corps at the very, very top level. Mm-hmm. And they were, of course, expected rigid discipline. They didn't want to negotiate with anybody, and the volunteers thought that was wrong. They thought that, you know, they should be consulted. They had democratic traditions to uphold, and they didn't want to be part of a professional army in the European sort of sense. And so, yes, there was a great deal of distrust of some West Pointers, not all of them. Some were surely seen in a harsh light. On the other hand, the West Pointers, of course, saw a lot of these political generals as men on the make. I mean, men trying to establish their reputation so that they could use that as a stepping stone to win office once the war was over. And the one they'd mistrust of these five, the one that they would have thought that way most about would have been James Garfield, who was a devious, tricky sort of fellow, and they had him right.
Well, when you look at their motivation for wanting to serve, how do you weigh up the relative contributions of, on the one hand, their wanting to serve their country, and on the other hand, some sort of thought that they might have had that experience would help them in their careers?
I think the only one that really gave that a whole lot of thought was Garfield. Mm-hmm. And you know, Garfield, Grant, and some of these were not all young men. Garfield was 29 when the war began. Grant was 38. Hayes was 38. They were fairly well developed and long in life. But Garfield was a state senator at the time the war began, and so he was already in politics. And he certainly had that in mind. And in fact, he was elected to the House of Representatives after only 2 years in the Army, and he took his seat in Washington in the House, still wearing his general's uniform. So he only lasted 2 years in the war, so obviously his interests were pretty clear. Not so in Hayes' case. Hayes is my favorite in the book, and Hayes is a very decent, patriotic politician and soldier, and he had nothing but the what he thought was the good of the country. He saw as the Union in mind, and he went to war in that way. So did McKinley. McKinley was only 18 when the war began. He was the only enlisted man, and he was the only real youngster in the whole bunch. And I think Harrison, although he wasn't a very likable fellow, I think Harrison's instincts were entirely patriotic and praiseworthy too.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're talking with James Perry. He's the author of the book Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. And it is indeed about the war experiences of these five, Grant, Garfield, Hayes, McKinley, and Harrison. Many U.S. presidents have served in combat, but the greatest number have come from the Civil War, and they are these five. If you're interested in taking a look at the book, it's out in the bookstores now. It's published by Public Affairs Books, and I'm sure you can find it. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. another of the things that most of these men shared, with the exception of McKinley, again, because of his age, they were all well-educated. They were all, other than McKinley, they all had graduated from college.
And even McKinley had gone to Allegheny College for a very short time. The war sort of served as his college, his coming of age for McKinley. It was his college education, really, was his time in the Union Army. And but the rest, you're absolutely right. The rest, of course, Grant went to West Point. Garfield graduated from Williams College, and so they all had their Harrison, Miami of Ohio. Hayes went to Kenyon and then to Harvard Law School. They were, as you say, they were well educated, and that served them well.
Grant, as you mentioned, one of the things about Grant, if you take a look at his life, is I think it's true, as you say, one wonders if, had it not been for the Civil War and his opportunity to serve in the military, whether
he ever heard of it.
Yeah, he certainly would not have been president of the United States. He had been unsuccessful more than once in business before going into the military.
That's the amazing thing. The amazing thing is how the war led these men. I mean, Grant, you can see that the others might have been governors or U.S. senators or probably not president. But with Grant, no way that he would have. Unless he changed entirely in how he dealt with life, he was a soldier, and that's what he was best at, and he was one of the great soldiers of all time.
Well, how is it that then to someone who, in other areas of life, seemed to be so unsuccessful, could be successful on the battlefield?
I guess it's a mystery. It's a complete mystery. Yeah. I don't think anybody who's ever written about Grant has ever solved it. How could he, for instance, have been such a great general and, by most historians' reckoning, been such a poor president? Well, you have to consider that being a general, even Grant was not one of these holy terror generals, but he was. Being a general, you know, you get so used to giving orders, and no one gave clearer, more specific orders on the battlefield than Ulysses Grant. Turned out, of course, and he wrote his memoirs. He was a wonderful writer as well. And so they have this tradition of they give orders and people go ahead, carry them out. Well, you get to be, I covered politics for 35 years, and you get to be a politician, you give an order, nothing happens. You know, you have to compromise with people. You have to have meetings. You have to have endless discussions. And politics is so much different than being a four-star general or any kind of general, for that matter.
One of the things that you read about Grant a lot, and maybe this is sort of an unfair or a simplification, but the thing that you see over and over again, the word applied to his approach to military strategy is aggressiveness. He was not a man that he was going to stand around.
That's the whole point. Right from the very beginning, he was unbelievably aggressive. This was the stage in the war when one of the great, like John C. Fremont, who was not aggressive at all, McClellan. I mean, the North had trouble finding aggressive generals, but they never had any doubt about Grant because I only take him through two battles I take him through Belmont, his first battle, which he was extremely aggressive, even though he was outnumbered by the Confederates and came very close to being defeated. He just barely escaped. And then he went on and took Forts Henry and Donelson, and he was very aggressive. And Donelson, he wasn't even supposed to go over and take Donelson, but he marched the 12 miles across. The 12 miles separated the two forts, marched across to Fort Donelson, and damned if he didn't capture the whole Confederate command there, 15,000, about 15,000 men. That's for the Civil War, that's a lot of men. And, of course, the Confederate commander wanted to negotiate the surrender, and he said no, he demanded unconditional surrender. And that became famous. The words unconditional surrender Grant became a sort of what everyone thought of him, and it matched his initials, which made it very nice too. So he, mm-hmm. he became a hero at that point. And my point is that after Fort Donelson, Saini went on to more and other victories, and on, it was almost inevitable that he would eventually go on to the White House.
Hmm. Dennis, I guess also one of the things for which he is often criticized, and people sit around and do become armchair generals, they talk about his recklessness and perhaps his willingness to sacrifice men, and the reason that he was successful, they'd say, was simply because he was willing to see so many of his men die.
Well, the truth is, in the Civil War, most generals saw huge casualties. I mean, we saw huge casualties. Hood, I mean, Hood at Franklin led this charge that resulted in a mass slaughter. It was just an extremely bloody war, and I don't know that Grant was any bloodier in his pursuit of it than many other generals, but that you're right, that is the reputation that he has. But Cold Harbor, there was one famous battle where he admits was his worst mistake, and he lost. He gets a lot of it comes from there.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me tell you again, is James Perry. We're talking about those American presidents who served in the Civil War. There were five of them. The war produced more presidents than any other of the American Wars. He's written about this in his book, Touched with Fire, and here the men we're talking about are Grant, Hayes, Garfield, McKinley, and Harrison. And questions are certainly are welcome. We do, in fact, have somebody here ready to go. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. And also, we do have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to start us off, and they are calling on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them on line one. Hello.
Yeah. I think, well, I'm no more than an armchair military historian myself, but I think that there's been, in some sense, an organized smear campaign against Grant, both as a general. I mean, during the war, there was clearly an organized smear campaign against him, in that, you know, people claim that he was constantly drunk and all this other stuff, and, but, I mean, I think it's easy to underestimate the problem that the Union had compared to the South. The South had to defend. The Union had to actually conquer the South, and that's going to mean lots of casualties. That's just how it is. I mean, I don't want to excuse anything, but you know, could it have been any different? Well, you know, who knows? Do you care to comment?
Well, that, your point is that Grant had to take the offensive. It was his
right,
and Lee had to. Lee was the point was to try to prolong the war long enough so that the North would get so tired of it that they would negotiate a peace settlement. Well, that's right. You're right. It's probably to make those frontal assaults is going to be very costly in terms of men lost. And the drinking problem, I think, is much exaggerated. I did an earlier book called about the press that covered the war, called A Bohemian Brigade, and that involved a newspaper reporter who was with Grant in the one celebrated incident when he did get drunk. But that's the only example that most anybody can find in the Civil War of Grant and his cups too much, and this was up there when he took a boat up the Yazoo River, and everyone tended to drink a good bit in the Civil War, that era. A lot of tough whiskey drinkers back then.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'd be interested, much as I admire Grant, I would be interested to hear about some of the other gentlemen on your list.
Well, let me just mention some. Rutherford B. Hayes, for example. Now, he was a very quiet, sickly young man when he grew up in Ohio, but he went off to war with the 23rd Ohio. Now, the amazing thing is that the Civil War Northern Regiment had about 1,000 men in it, and the 23rd Ohio had two future presidents in it. And it's amazing that they had Hayes and it had McKinley. Now, Hayes was the commander, and much admired by his men, greatly revered by them, and he was very good, very understanding of how to command volunteers. But it's, he fought with that absolutely ferocious. He was a really wonderful, vigorous, aggressive colonel and a regimental commander, and no one, not having known him before, could believe it. But he, at some of these battles, distinguished himself by his bravery. He was wounded four times, once seriously at South Mountain, which was the battle that preceded Antietam, on the bloodiest day of the war, and he was left to die on the battlefield, and was finally dragged away and treated by the regimental surgeon, who fortunately was his brother-in-law. He was married to his wife, was the brother of his wife Lucy, and he survived. But he was a serious, hard-fighting colonel, and just the sort of regimental commander that the North needed most. So you have to be amazed by the ferocity with which he functioned in the war, and with the skill with which he commanded his regiment, sometimes a larger unit, a brigade. So that's him. Garfield is in some ways the most interesting of the all, because he was so devious and so tricky, and he was probably the smartest of the bunch. Other than Grant, he was the only one to command an army in the field, although it was a very small one. It was in the Big Sandy Valley in eastern Kentucky, a wonderful campaign against a Falstaffian Confederate figure named Humphrey Marshall, a 300-pounder West Pointer. And Garfield just outfought him, and eventually chased him all the way back into Virginia. It was a great success, and got a good deal of publicity at the time. He went on from there to be Rosecrans's chief of staff and was with him at Chickamauga and distinguished himself there. So he saw some real combat. You want me to go over the last two? I'll do a little
better. Sure, yeah,
McKinley.
Go ahead.
McKinley was so young, he was, as I say, he was with the 23rd Ohio, he'd been so well educated, could write clearly, and without making a lot of, most of these people couldn't spell very well or write very clearly, but he could. So he became a commissary sergeant, and then he became quartermaster, and got some behind the lines functions. He was famous. He also saw a good bit of fighting. We have to give him credit for that. But at Antietam, this was after Hayes had been wounded. At Antietam, the 23rd Ohio became kind of, had fought for a while and became kind of cornered, and they had nothing to eat, nothing to drink, and they were in pretty poor shape. So McKinley seized a wagon and two horses and got on it with another young private, and stashed on the wagon all sorts of rations and hot coffee and all sorts of things, and rushed it across the battlefield, across through shot and shell, across the battlefield to where his men were, to where the 23rd Ohio was, and they were delighted to see him. And one of the old sergeants said, "God bless the boy." And McKinley always said those were the kindest words he ever heard in his whole life. So he became famous for that dash across the battlefield in his carriage. Now Harrison is the least likable of all these people. He had no small talk and rigid disciplinarian, was never really loved by his troops. But finally, at the end of the war, saw a great deal of fighting and Sherman's march to Atlanta, and he commanded the 70th Indiana. And they finally saw a lot of fighting, much more than his grandfather, William Henry Harrison, President William Henry Harrison, had ever seen. And he was very conscious of his family traditions and family history, and He saw a lot of action in that final campaign with marching to Atlanta, and did some good work. So there they are. They all did their thing.
It's remarkable sometimes when you read about the battlefield exploits of particular people who became well known for that.
Yeah.
That on the one hand, sometimes you have to applaud their courage, and that was something that came to be recognized. On the other hand, sometimes perhaps you look at what they did and you think that wasn't terribly smart. that in fact they could just have easily have easily been killed. It could have turned out to have been a disaster.
Absolutely.
Rather than ending up with fame and a medal and promotion.
Yes, on any battlefield, there's always some of that, I suppose. Yeah. And this in McKinley's case, I suppose, when he first loaded up that wagon, had no idea that he was going to come under quite so heavy fire and getting to his. Where he was going, but once he started, he couldn't very well turn around, so he went ahead. He did some other times when he was a messenger, dashed across battlefields and almost got shot. Garfield did the same thing at Chickamauga, and it became very famous. He went, his commanding officer went into sort of a funk, Rosecrans, but George Thomas, the famous Rock of Chickamauga, was holding out, and it was important to find out how he was doing and how long he could stay in his position. So Garfield wrote one of these famous gallops across the battlefield. He did the same thing, and a famous poem was written about it, and all of his campaigns. This material, of course, was widely used by anybody who had some of this combat experience to be sure let everybody know about it.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a listener in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. You said that Hayes was one of the ones that you admired the most, and if I remember correctly, Reconstruction ended under Hayes. So my question is, and when you look at these five, as presidents, what was their policy towards reintegrating the freed slaves into society, or did they have any? Because I know Lincoln sort of had a plan of hoping to repatriate a great number, so there wouldn't be that issue at all. So did any of these five men develop a policy? And I guess in the back of my mind, I keep wondering, how could such a decent person pretty much condemn a whole group of people to a very sad period in history?
Well, with Hayes, of course, the election itself, of course, is highly questionable whether he actually won it or not. But McFeely, one of Grant's biographers, says that by the end of Grant's second term, there wasn't a single person in the White House who gave a damn about the black man. Mm-hmm. So that's a terrible damning indictment, and probably not entirely true, but pretty close to it. Yeah. By the end of Grant's second term, the efforts to protect and encourage the newly freed slaves to survive in those 11 formerly breakaway Confederate states had pretty much collapsed. The Reconstruction effort enforced by the military was almost over by the time that Hayes became president. And it is not. This is not a pleasant or encouraging chapter in the history of America, what was done by these presidents, but they simply figured that there's nothing they could do, and the country was moving on to other things. There was no political push by anybody to enforce the freedom for the newly freed slaves. It is not a happy part of the history, no.
Well, it sort of brings up a point that you hear again and again when people discuss the Civil War. Someone commented, perhaps even on this show not too long ago, that there were two movies made, Cold Mountain and Of Gods and Generals, where the issue of slavery was really almost not brought in at all. And you almost have two ways this history is always told. History of the future of the United States, the Federation, or is this a moral issue of slavery? And my question is, what do you think these five men were fighting for?
No question with the five of them. And what do you find in most letters, Civil War letters from Union soldiers? It was to save the Union. They fought to save the Union. And that was overwhelmingly their passion. And you find lots of letters, lots of Northern soldiers were not at all friendly to the notion of freeing the slaves. Mm-hmm. And so with these five men, some of them felt strongly about slavery. Garfield had, early on when he was at Williams College, had become very much an abolitionist and had felt that strongly. But really, the point I make is what they fought for, what they thought they were fighting for, was the whole notion of preserving the Union, not allowing the 11 states to break away to form a new nation.
Thank you.
And that drove them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We are now past our midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580, talking with James Perry. He is the author of the book Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. It's published by Public Affairs Books, and it indeed looks at the war experiences of these five men. They were all Republicans: Grant, Garfield, Harrison, Hayes, and McKinley. And as I've said a couple of times, and certainly he makes the point in his book, that while many people who have gone on to the presidency have had experience in combat, most of them, the greatest number, these five, had their experiences during the Civil War. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think in the book you talk about the fact that as far as Grant was concerned about himself, he became president because he deserved to be president.
He thought he probably did.
That was just for him, based on what he had done. That seemed to be just the natural step. The problem was that while he certainly was a good soldier and he knew how to be a soldier, he did not know how to be president.
Right. And I don't suppose anybody does, actually. Yeah. When they eventually walk into that office, but no, I don't think he had any. He had any idea that what direction the country would take with him as president.
With these other men, they are not men that we think of as being in the top tier of U.S. presidents, and certainly at this period, the Gilded Age is a time that we think of being notorious for corruption in politics.
Right.
Were any of the other of them, do you think, really well suited to be the president or knew to be president?
The big question, because two of them were assassinated.
So we really don't know.
But Garfield had only been in office for 4 months when he was assassinated, and which time he'd had some problems with the appointments. But he was the smartest of the lot, and as I say, it was said that he could write in Latin with one hand and in Greek with the other all at the same time. I'm not sure this is absolutely verifiable, but he was bright, and he was also devious, and I make the point that sometimes being smart and being devious combines to make a pretty good president. I mean, you think of The Lion and the Fox with Franklin Roosevelt, for example. But he's a mystery. We don't know what kind of president he would have been because he didn't get a chance to serve out his term. And McKinley has his moments. McKinley led us into the modern world arena by leading us by being the commander in chief and leading America into the victorious Spanish American War, and so he gets some credit for doing some important things. The others really didn't do anything. Harrison did absolutely nothing that was memorable except give pensions to lots of veterans who didn't actually deserve them, and the others didn't really much have a chance.
Let's go on. We'll talk with someone else here locally. Line 1, Urbana. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering if Mr. Martin would consider a sequel with the effect of the presidents who served, or at least were in the service, during World War II and their subsequent presidencies. I count 6. Eisenhower, Nixon, Ford, Johnson, Bush, Kennedy.
But who saw combat is the...
Yeah, that was. I was wondering. I heard both you and
the 95, I actually say, saw combat. There are two others who served in the Civil War. Andrew Johnson actually was a general, and Arthur was a general as well, but they never saw combat.
Okay. But the parallel in terms of the number of presidents who were in the service and the impact of the war.
Yeah, I don't know how many in this. A good many saw combat in the And the elder Bush saw combat. Exactly. Gerald Ford was on an aircraft carrier and saw a lot of combat.
Kennedy, of course.
What?
Kennedy, of course.
Kennedy was, yes, his ship was sunk.
And Johnson, it was claimed, saw combat.
Well, he's had that one flight where he...
got the Silver Star.
I was actually traveling with him once. And,
oh, my gosh.
We went up there and visited this spot where he took this flight that involved what was supposed to be a fairly routine bombing run, and actually they ran into some flak, and he came in. So Roosevelt gave him a Silver Star for this.
I remember, yeah.
Ludicrous performance. So he was in the Navy. Saw that one. that one flight he took, right.
Well, thank you for an interesting conversation.
All right, thanks. Well, that does raise the question, and I think I'm in promoting the program, did indeed make that parallel between the way that we think about this group of people that whoever coined the phrase has come to be thought of as the greatest generation, those people who served in World War II, and certainly a lot of them went on to become important in America and in American politics. Do you see that some parallels between that, though, the men of that generation who served in World War II and those who served in the Civil War?
Yeah, I like to think that, Brokaw wrote this book about the greatest generation, these World War II veterans. Well, the Civil War veterans were the Northern veterans. This doesn't go over very well in the South, of course, but the Northern veterans like to think of themselves as a great generation. They'd done a great service. They'd saved the Union, and I think that's a fair interpretation of what they did. I like to think of them that way, and I think of them that way in this book.
Let's talk with a caller in Belgium by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to talk to your guest about the aspect that during the administrations of many of these generals after the Civil War, weren't there a lot of real nasty little scoundrels who were running around doing...
Oh, the place was filled with them.
Yeah, they seemed to be just hanging on.
But
everywhere.
No one has ever accused any of these presidents of being... Well, Garfield, possibly. No one's ever accused any of these generals of being corrupt themselves. Grant hung out with a lot of these robber barons and used to have dinner with them, and, Jubilee, Jim Fisk and Gould and all that bunch. But no one has ever said he shouldn't have done it. It was bad judgment on his part. But no one's ever said he was corrupt. And then the Tweed, the City Hall... It was building the City Hall in New York that cost more than we paid for Alaska. You know, the corruption was it was all over the place at all levels.
Arthur
was corrupt. I mean, he'd been the collector of customs in New York, which was the biggest boondoggle political giveaway job in the country, and so he. But he turned out to be a fairly honest and hardworking president.
The other thing I was going to point out that it seems the Civil War was, at that time, really fought more for states' rights than it was for slavery. Slavery came in as actually an item later on in the war, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I explained. These five men, The motivation, the leading motivation for all five of these men was saving the Union. And you just read that over and over again in all their letters. And we have a lot of their letters, which is wonderful. But Hayes, we have all of them. And that was the principal motivation there, was they wanted to prevent these 11 states from breaking away and breaking up the Union. And that's what they wanted to do. Slavery, some felt strongly about it, some did not. It was not universal. Saving the Union was universal.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Back again, I guess we're preoccupied with the issue of political corruption, but it's something that you can't quite get away from, and you wonder in this case of these men you begin to question their judgment because they had some questionable friends. Grant seemed to be the worst. Would you say that somehow they were not good judges of character outside of the military sphere, or was it the fact that they were simply associating with the people who were the movers and shakers of the time, which is something that politicians have always done?
I don't know. That's a good question. Whether they were more attracted to scoundrels and rogues than other people, I mean, Washington was filled with scoundrels and rogues. I mean, the Congress was filled with scoundrels and rogues. You could hardly avoid scoundrels and rogues, you know, in that period. So they couldn't have avoided them very well because that was the way of the way life was. And every city had political machines and corruption. So it was a time when you had to deal with people of consequence who made decisions. You almost inevitably would deal, at least at some point, with us rogues and scoundrels, because that's for the people who held the jobs. So I don't know how you could, a president or anybody, a governor, could have avoided at least the association with people of less than honorable intentions.
Mm-hmm. As time goes along, it seems to be less and less likely that we will have a president who's had combat experience.
Well, we have one running at the moment.
We do have one running.
Well, we have two. We have Kerry and Clark both running, and both have combat experience. And Kerry, well, who knows what's happening in New Hampshire today, but
yeah.
Kerry allegedly is ahead there, and he had a lot of combat experience.
Certainly he did, and we would certainly single him out as having that qualification if you think that's
And I think it works
important.
For him. I think a decisive moment, and as an old political writer now, a decisive moment was when that fellow that served on the boat with him in Vietnam showed up in Iowa. And they hadn't seen each other in years. And this is the fellow he'd rescued and saved in this very emotional meeting of the two. And that deeply moved me. I mean, just watching it. But here, these two men, had served their country and been through some terrible times together. And here they were meeting for the first time since those days. I have no doubt that it still has a lingering effect on the vote that's going on right now.
Mm. Well, that gets us to, I guess, the question I was thinking about was whether, having had that experience, whether we think that that's a good experience for someone we want to be president in terms of shaping their character. But here you're talking about something different. You're talking about public perception and the fact that apparently people still...
Does it make them a better president,
yeah.
You're asking, really?
Yeah. Right, yes.
I'm not sure. It doesn't. Well, there have been good. We've had three great general presidents. We've had Washington, Jackson, and Eisenhower. Three great, all generals and all substantial presidents. At least historians generally concede that to all three of them. We've had others that, Franklin Pierce. I mean, what did his service help in being president? So it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think Americans have a sneaking appreciation for men who've seen combat because it demonstrates to them, A, that they're patriotic, B, that they probably have some experience with discipline, and it does work. It doesn't necessarily make a good president. You're quite right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is... There's no way we can tell what makes a good president until they're there, and then suddenly people we never would have guessed would be good presidents. I mean, Harry Truman. Who would have guessed Harry Truman would turn out to be sometimes rated as our fourth or fifth greatest president? I mean, who would ever have guessed that? But he of course seen service in World War I.
Let's talk with someone else. We have another Chicago listener here, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I tuned in late, so I didn't get the benefit of your description of the people who became president who were generals. But what I want to do is take issue with the view that you have regarding those presidents following Lincoln, and that is that the problem was that the abolitionists essentially, who had been in control of the party up until Grant, were driven out of power, and the people who then controlled the Republican Party were the robber barons, and this explains all the corruption
all the way through
up to McKinley and beyond it up to the present day, because the Republican Party at that point, following Grant, or during Grant's administration, afterwards made a deal with the Southern, with the Southerners, the former slave owners who wanted to control things down there, and they in essence control the economy of the United States, and the Republican, the Republicans, those who benefited from the Republicans were the robber barons, and they got the run of the country, and the Southerners, the Southern Democrats, those who became the Southern Democrats, the former slave owners, controlled the South, and eventually they controlled Congress. So all you have to do is read the Cairo's biography of Lyndon Johnson, and you'll get a fairly decent picture of what the heck was going on all during that time, ever since Washington, essentially.
Well, unquestionably, the robber barons in corruption were widespread, and I don't think.
But it was essentially Republicans.
Well, the Republicans held power, of course, but
sure.
But I mean, and Teddy Roosevelt came along, and he was a progressive, and
Teddy Roosevelt was brought in as vice president, and the people who controlled those who controlled the party then, the McKinleyites. I forget the political leader from Ohio. I forget his name now, but Roosevelt was brought in order to put a weak in order to take away his power. He was they didn't want him as president. And
well, no, but they got him, and he reasserted the powers of the presidency, and is generally conceded to be one of our very superior presidents. And I think that's fair to say.
But he wasn't considered part of that group who were the robber barons.
No, he wasn't. He was. The political hacks were deeply suspicious of him. They thought he was a reformer, and
he was. In New York,
up to a certain extent, at least he was. Yeah.
Well, it seems that you and the caller are in agreement, at least on that point, that he was.
Yeah, I think we're pretty.
The powers that be at the time never had the intention or never expected that Teddy Roosevelt would end up being president of the United States.
Well, after the Rough Riders, and of course he achieved this great fame on the battlefield too, leading the Rough Riders in Cuba and. I remember writing a book once in the boss in New York, the political boss, after they came back from Cuba, said he was afraid there was absolutely nothing he could do to keep Roosevelt from being governor, and of course on he went from there to being president, and it was fairly inevitable once again because he becomes such a national hero.
We are coming down to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes left, maybe three or 4 minutes, and I guess I want to stick with the idea of the book, and that is what it is we perhaps end up learning about these men, knowing about their experience in the Civil War, how that if all we knew about them was how they performed as President of the United States, that maybe that would be an incomplete picture of who they were.
That's the point of the book, and that's exactly what I wrote the book was that. The most important years of their lives were not the years they spent as in the White House and as President of the United States. And this is absolutely true. And the most important years of their lives were the time they spent as the Boys in Blue, Lincoln's soldiers in the Civil War, and the contribution they made to saving the Union. And that's the story I think that they would like to have told, and the story that I think I have told in this book.
Do you think that they felt
that was the high point of their lives? In fact, some of them straight out say that, yes. They always like to be called, McKinley always liked to be called Major McKinley, and they all went to all the reunions and the encampments of the Civil War veterans. Harrison more than probably any of the others, absolutely was devoted to doing everything he could for Union veterans and in promoting the cause of the Grand Army of the Republic and the veterans of the war.
Well, were veterans and veterans organizations important forces in politics?
Absolutely. There were 1.5 million veterans and their families and their friends and associates, and they became a hugely powerful force in American politics. Right up, even until McKinley's time, and although they're beginning to fade away by then. But yes, the Grand Army of the Republic, GAR, was, although technically neutral, was on the side of Republican veterans and Republican candidates for president. And they were a very powerful force.
Well, I think at that we will have to stop because we come here to the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book we have been talking about. It's titled Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them by our guest James Perry. You might be interested in one of his other books. His most recent is a book about the reporters who covered the Civil War, and that book is titled A Bohemian Brigade. The book Touched with Fire is published by Public Affairs Books. By our guest, James Perry. And Mr. Perry, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm glad.
We appreciate it.
Matt.